Welcome to Let It Roll, Tales from the Tour Bus, where the podcast about how and why popular music happens takes a break to talk about our favorite animated music history show from Mike Judge with hosts Nate Wilcox and Justin Bankston. Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You can now follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and we'd love to hear what you think, so don't be shy about tweeting at us or commenting on our website. This week, Nate and Justin talk about the fifth episode of Tales from the Tour Bus, featuring legendary outlaw songwriter Billy Joe Shaver. Tales from the Tour Bus can be viewed on Amazon.com if you subscribe to Cinemax. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
Hello, I'm Nate Wilcox, host of the Let It Roll podcast. I'm joined once again by Justin Bankston for our obsessive compulsive deep dive discussions into Mike Judge's Tales from the Tour Bus. Tonight we're going to talk about the Billy Joe Shaver episode. Justin, welcome back.
Hello. I can't wait to talk about Billy Joe, this guy.
This man is a character, as we say in Texas.
Indeed.
Yes, and so Billy Joe Shaver, best known as a songwriter, but also a singer, songwriter, and performer, and recording artist, even had a major label tenure for a while in the 80s, but best known for writing virtually the entirety of Waylon Jennings' legendary Honky Tonk Heroes album, and more than a fitting subject for Tales from the Tour Bus.
Indeed, he is a Central Texas legend.
Yes, and the episode makes it pretty clear why. With musical highlights, a poignant childhood story, many ups and downs on the road to legendary status, and, of course, a shooting with Billy Joe on the shooting end. So
he's a shooter.
He's a shooter. So the basic plot summary is Billy Joe Shaver, born in Central Texas, raised by his grandmother, and this is the sad part of it, basically abandoned by his mother after his father nearly kicked the child to death while his mother was pregnant. Then the mother told the grandmother that if it was a girl, she'd stay. If it was a boy, she'd leave. And it was a boy, and she left. So, you know, they don't start the episode with that, though. They start with some hijinks at the Canadian border, which seems to be a theme with this series. And they're going to get to it more, but so we meet the band. Rugi Ray LaMontagne is his French harp player, who Billy Joe describes as this crazy Yankee he hired. Freddie Fletcher on drums and Dan Poobah Mueller, the roadie. So, any thoughts on the band in the background and how it differs from the previous episodes in the series, Justin?
Well, it is. You know, it's sort of a short episode, and it's sort of, you know, it's really enjoyable all the way through, but it's also really kind of like low-key funny the whole time, but there's not a whole ton of ups and downs. It seems like when they're talking about the bad stuff that happened and they're talking about the good stuff that happened, there's sort of like, you know, it's all enjoyable. The tragedy doesn't really come across all that awful. You know, I mean, obviously he had an inauspicious start, you know, with no mom or dad, but it seemed like he got raised up okay. And then, you know, all of the ups and downs are relatively shenanigans-y and fun to hear about.
It's true. And I think having Kinky Friedman as the teller who relates the most poignant parts takes some of the edge off because of Kinky's inimitable dry humor and wit. And so, that definitely softens the blow a little bit. And the structure of the episode, I think, does it too, because it starts out with a classic sort of Tales from the Road, the band hiding their stash. You know, Billy Joe's going to go across the Canadian border and play some gigs in Canada, so he tells the band, you know, no drugs. And so they have to pull over right before the border, hide their stash of guns and drugs and knives, and of course they can't remember which mile marker they buried it at. Then they backtrack, Yeah, go ahead.
It's another, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's another great example of the editing and the visual style. Like, there's just this great sight gag of all this stuff going into this beer box as they're digging out bags of drugs and guns and knives and a belt buckle that's also a knife, and, you know,
brass
some
knuckles.
Foreshadowing as Billy Joe's pop gun goes in there. Yeah, and some, maybe somebody had some brass knuckles, well, let's throw those in there. And it's just such a great visual gag, and they just, it's just a great example of what is so entertaining about the show.
Yeah, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. This is the funniest thing I think that Mike Judge has done since Beavis and Butthead. And it's also some of the best music documentaries ever, which is why we're talking about it on the show. But the combination of the animation and the spoken narration, it lets them tell the stories in a really compelling way. So it's not just talking heads, and it's not just looking at old dudes on screen like a lot of music documentaries. The animation lets you go back into the past and see the stories as they happen. And the quintessential tale is that they get into pretty early in this episode is when they go back in time to Billy as a 7 or 8 year old who walks barefoot along 6 miles of railroad tracks in a coveralls or overalls to go see Homer and Jethro, who are the Thinking Man's hillbillies, and accidentally sees Hank Williams Sr. And little Billy Joe climbs up on a pillar to get away from the crowd who are sniffing on his bare feet, and feels like Hank Sr. is singing right to him. And to me, that's the most powerful part of the episode. I mean, it's the origin story of Billy Joe Shaver. It's like being anointed by the Christ himself, you know, the king of country music, passing the torch right on to Billy Joe Shaver. And sort of a reminder that the 70s generation of outlaw country singers got to see and know the 50s generation of singers directly, which from the distance of 2019, it's kind of hard to grasp. I mean, you're not going to meet many people these days who actually saw Hank Williams Sr. perform. But Billy Joe Shaver is one of them, and he's still walking around. So, you know, that was powerful. And it gives him a great – I think one of the challenges in this episode is, so Billy Joe Shaver is not known as a great singer, although I think that's a little unfair. I've come to know, especially after this episode – before I watched this episode, I pretty much only heard his stuff – aside from a couple of his best-known songs, I'd pretty much known his stuff through cover versions, not just Waylon Jennings, but also Kris Kristofferson and Johnny Cash and other people, David Allan Coe. But getting, you know, the Hank Williams cameo is a great excuse to throw in a Hank Williams singing Move It On Over and padding out the song selection a little bit. But they start off with Billy Joe singing Old Five and Dimers Like Me, which is one of his best-known songs. It starts the classic Honky Tonk Heroes album by Waylon. And then, you know, after they tell the tale of the great anointing by Hank Sr., they tell the other part of the origin story, which is how Billy Joe lost, I think, 2 or 3 fingers on his strumming hand.
Not entirely clear. At least big parts of 2 fingers are definitely missing.
Yeah, and the you know, cartoon Billy Joe waves that hand around quite a bit, and if you've ever seen Billy Joe live, he'll make sure you know that he's lost his fingers as well. and then gets into his Nashville apprenticeship, and also the sort of arbitrary way. I think this is a quintessential moment in the Billy Joe Shaver story, is that, you know, he decides to leave Texas. He's got to get out of the sawmill and make it as a musician. And he goes to hitchhike west. His goal is Los Angeles. And, you know, like so many Texas musicians who made it out to California, ended up making it, but nobody's driving that way. So he crosses the road and goes east. Next stop, Nashville. And that's where they introduce Bobby Bear, I don't know if you'd call him a superstar, but a very successful singer-songwriter in his own right, who hired Billy Joe to work for a song publishing company. And Bobby Bear tells some of the stories on Billy Joe and his Nashville apprenticeship, as it were, including his roommate, who liked to hold a knife to his throat and recite Tennyson.
Yeah, that was a really funny sequence. And, incredibly bizarre, but you get the feeling it's 100% true.
Yeah, yeah, and the whole unreliable narrator nature of this stuff is definitely explored. I mean, Kinky Friedman comes in early, making a bold claim that, you know, Billy Joe don't lie and he only tells the truth. But later on, of course, Willie Nelson tells Attorney Dick DeGaren, you know, you can't trust a word that comes out of Billy Joe's mouth. And the Billy Joe's account of the shooting requires Mike Judge to step in and present some truth. So it's not quite Johnny Paycheck, but there's definitely an unreliable narrator aspect to this episode as well. And but the story of Hal Bynum coming in and reading the Alfred Lord Tennyson Charge of the Light Brigade to him while he held a knife to his throat, and then Billy Joe saying, "I don't know why I didn't leave. I guess I like the poetry." Bobby Bear correcting it. "No, I think he liked the knife." I found that a tad cryptic, but
I mean, that's definitely an aspect. Like, it's been definitely a through line in the whole series, is that, you know, that these tales are all on the tall side. You know, there's a little bit of embroidery that's going on, you know, pretty much at every turn, but that's part of what makes it great, and it's part of the storytelling tradition. If you're a Texas songwriter, you're not going to tell a story to somebody without tarting it up a little bit. I mean, that would just be lazy.
Exactly. And you know, Billy Joe definitely knows how to build a myth and a legend. And a big part of the Billy Joe legend, and it's pretty much an essential part of any of the 60s era performers, is the LSD conversion experience, which, you know, after a few years of apprenticeship in Nashville and taking plenty of pills, he comes back to Austin. According to Billy Joe, he was supposed to be opening up for the Grateful Dead at the Armadillo World headquarters. According to scholars that I've read about online, there's no record of a gig that listed, you know, there's no posters that show the Grateful Dead and Billy Joe Shaver on the same poster or anything. But be that as it may, Billy Joe's version of the story is he missed the gig, shows up, and the management hands him a roll of toilet paper that was expressly delivered, you know, "Please give this to Billy Joe." And that was apparently full. Every sheet was a blotter of Owsley acid. And anybody knows their Grateful Dead mythology, that's August Owsley III, the sound man and the LSD kingpin who financed the whole Grateful Dead band with his acid profits from the San Francisco scene in the late 60s. And Billy Joe eats a couple of hits of acid and has, you know, this massive conversion experience, is bitten by brown recluse spiders, and then wonders about...
Which then dies. The recluse spider does not survive biting Billy Joe.
Yes. I think that's a warning to anybody who wants to mess with the man. And it's not made clear is if, or maybe I missed it, but the acid is given to him at the world headquarters, but he's still having an acid experience at one of the early Willie Nelson picnics in Dripping Springs. And that's where he bumps into Waylon Jennings, wanders into a peanut trailer. Billy Joe's having messianic visions, thinks he's Jesus and can heal people, goes into a peanut-shaped trailer and starts singing his songs, and somebody comes out of the back, and it's Waylon Jennings, like, who wrote them cowboy songs? And Billy Joe says, "It's me, my songs." And then, you know, that's what leads to the fateful Honky Tonk Heroes album, where Waylon records a whole album of Billy Joe's songs. And anybody who knows anything about the music business knows that the songwriting credits are the most lucrative thing on an album. And for Waylon Jennings to give an entire album or all but one song to one songwriter who's basically unknown, I mean, that's an incredible statement of confidence in Billy Joe Shaver's songwriting right there.
It really is. And it's such like a bizarre turn of fortune. You know, as you said, he's wandering through the hill country, you know, on a half a toilet paper roll of Owsley acid, and runs into a Waylon Jennings trailer and sings a song, and this leads to Waylon Jennings deciding to cut a whole record of these songs and changing music and setting up Billy Joe to be, you know, essentially able to continue to do what he's doing.
Yeah, and also is a pivotal moment in the whole outlaw country movement, because that's the first album by Waylon and first album by anybody that's definitively outlaw country, and kicks off a whole cultural sea change in Texas and Nashville and around the world. And, you know, basically sets up Billy Joe for life, you know, as a paying proposition to have that kind of songwriter royalties on a Waylon Jennings album. You know, I mean, it wasn't as big a deal when Waylon made the agreement with them as it was, as it turned out to be. I mean, I don't think anybody knew Waylon was going to become, you know, a multi-platinum album selling superstar. Not that Honky Tonk Heroes was multi-platinum right away, but still, you know, and that's kind of the happy ending. And then the rest of the episode, they spend telling a late in life misadventure that Billy Joe got into outside Waco on his way home from what I believe is his third wedding to a second wife. As they outline, he married two women in his life, but
three
both of
each.
Them, yeah, three times each, married and divorced. And this one with the second wife, you know, Billy Gibbons.
Billy Joe is a true romantic.
Yes, clearly. And Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, who apparently presided over the wedding and, as Billy Joe accuses him, perhaps consummated it as well, tells the tale of presiding over the wedding and, you know, tells how he's very touched. This means a lot. And Billy Joe's, oh, it ain't no big deal. I do this all the time. And then after the ceremony, Billy goes to the casino to find the reception and asks where it is. And somebody points to the middle of the casino and he's like, what? Where? And he says, oh, there they are. They're on the floor. And Billy Joe is rolling around on the floor doing Indian leg wrestling and actually breaks his neck doing this. And then that's why he's unavailable and suspects that Billy and is it Brenda, his second wife, Brenda or Wendy? And
Wanda,
my bad. Billy Joe suspects that Billy Gibbons spent the night with Wanda. So they go back to Texas to get divorced. That's where they pull in to the infamous honky tonk. And it goes into what the, pulling up my notes and see what the name of the honky tonk. Papa Joe's outside Waco, and as his drummer says, it's not the kind of place you pull in at if you have any sense.
and when you see the photo of it, if you've ever driven from Austin to Dallas, and I've done that 200 times, you see Papa Joe's on the side of the road. It's this big metal building, and it has Papa Joe's painted on the side of it, really huge, and it's obviously not a place you go. It's just clearly from the highway you can tell, yeah, I'm not gonna go there.
Yeah I mean, it is definitely rough and ready, but somehow Billy Jonas and Wanda sit down on the way to go home and get divorced, and a gentleman invites himself to their table, and Billy Joe accuses the guy, says that the guy's stirring drinks with a knife and hitting on Wanda, and also dissing him. He says he doesn't mind the guy hitting on his wife because we're getting divorced, but he doesn't like him dissing him. So he says, why don't you shut the fuck up? And look, man, you got to apologize or something. And so that's when Billy Joe claims that they get ready to go outside. And according to Billy Joe, the band leader hands the guy a gun. The guy shoots at Billy Joe three times, and that's when Mike Judge has to step in and say, nope, witness accounts, police records, and trial transcripts all agree the man had a knife, not a gun. But Billy Joe, nonetheless, right, pulls out his .22 Derringer, shoots him right between the mother and the fucker, as he says,
yes.
And then goes on.
He says, I realized I had to return fire.
Exactly. And so, and then that leads to the whole trial, and Dale Watson calls him and asks him if he can write a song about this, which comes back to haunt him in the trial. Connie Nelson brings in a lawyer who bails him out for $50,000. They eventually, after he fires multiple lawyers who want him to plead guilty, hires the legendary Dick DeGaren, who's the lawyer to Tom DeLay, David Koresh, and Bobby Durst of HBO Infamy. And DeGaren gets him off. I know. And it really, it seems more like Billy Joe got himself off. I mean, they don't cite any evidence of genius lawyering by DeGaren, just putting Billy Joe on the stand where he says, you know, ma'am, I'm from Texas. I ain't no chicken shit on the stand.
Yes.
You know,
it reminds me of the great Texas defense, which is a legendary, there's a legendary lawyer in Texas. I can't remember his name. And he got a lot of people off of these charges. And the basis of his defense was, I'm not saying my client didn't shoot that guy. I'm saying that guy needed shooting.
Exactly.
And there was a time where that really did fly in Texas. And evidently it's up to as recently as Billy Joe Shaver's trial.
In the late 1980s. And I wouldn't go up against that defense right now if I was a prosecutor. It's going to be tough to get a conviction in Texas. So all's well that ends well. Billy Joe survives his celebrity trial and is acquitted and rides off in the sunset. They sort of gloss over some of the biggest tragedy in Billy's later life was the death of his son, Eddie, who... It doesn't mention on the show, but Eddie was a great lead guitar player and played on Billy's albums from, I think, the early 1980s on, all the way up to his death on New Year's Eve 2000 from a heroin overdose. So, you know, that's definitely a little heavy for the tone of the show. And so they kind of allude to it, but move on. And so
yeah, they gloss right over it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they mention it, but don't dive into it. And they also skip over what he meant for Billy Joe's career, because he played on his Columbia debut album, I'm Just an Old Chunk of Coal. And that was one of the big rewards for me of this show, was checking out Billy Joe's solo career. And his son Eddie was definitely a pretty badass classic Telecaster country guitar slinger.
Absolutely. And co-wrote Live Forever with Billy Joe.
Yep. And so, you know, a bigger loss than they allude to. So that's the basic plot summary. Any commentary on the speaker? I think we've mentioned everybody. I mentioned Connie Nelson. Yeah. Willie Nelson's third wife also comes in, and Dick DeGaren comes in a little bit. And the echoes back to the Johnny Paycheck episode because of the trial are pretty clear. And as in the Johnny Paycheck episode, you know, we hear from his band, we hear from his attorney, we hear from his friends. And this functions in the series very much like the Johnny Paycheck episode did, in that it's a prequel to a two-parter, just like Johnny Paycheck set up the George Jones and Tammy Wynette two-parter. Billy Joe sets up the two-part Waylon Jennings episode.
Yeah, that works really great.
Yeah.
And one thing I wanted to point out that I was rewatching it again today, and they sort of blame Dale Watson for putting the line in the song, Where Do You Want It?, which comes up at the trial, where they basically allege that Billy Joe asked the guy where he wanted it before he shot him in the face. And but at one point before that, they show a picture of a newspaper article, and I spotted in that newspaper article the phrase, Where Do You Want It? So it had been reported in the paper that Billy Joe had said that to the guy before shooting him. So I don't know that Dale should be entirely blamed for that.
That's a good catch. And I'm glad you brought up that whole thing, because the whole meta aspect of the song about the shooting coming up at the trial, I mean, it's as if, you know, you're at the trial of, you know, Billy the Kid or something, and somebody's quoting the Bob Dylan song about him. I mean, it's very meta to have the song about the shooting published, out, released, recorded, and impacting the testimony at the trial. Is very meta, but and you're making it even
also a wonderful sort of Texas tall tale type of situation.
Absolutely, and well worth immortalizing in Billy Joe's own song, Wacko from Waco, that they play. So there's a few more songs in this episode than there are in some of the others, but a couple of them get kind of short shrift. Billy Joe opens it doing Old Five and Dimers Like Me, which is in the spot early in the episode where they really want to present, let you hear for yourself the power of this person's performance. And I think for Billy Joe, like, his own performances are a little bit of an acquired taste. And so the one that really gets over the most is Waylon Jennings doing Honky Tonk Heroes. I mean, it's Billy Joe's songs have reached enormous audiences and impacted people greatly, but generally when they're sung by people like Waylon Jennings or Johnny Cash or David Allan Coe, who are more traditional, powerful singers than Billy Joe. But I think it's perfectly appropriate to feature Billy Joe singing his own songs in this episode. But, you know, then they get Hank Williams doing Move It On Over. Then they have Billy Joe doing Black Rose. Then they have Waylon Jennings doing Honky Tonk Heroes, and they give that a pretty long feature. And then they have Dale Watson, this version of Where Do You Want It? And then a little bit, and that's a fairly abbreviated, and then a fairly abbreviated version of Wacko from Waco by Billy Joe. And then they end it with Live Forever by Billy Joe, which is pretty good. Any thoughts on the song selection in the episode?
Yeah, I think the way they started with the, I mean, Old Five and Dimers is a great song, but the greatest thing about it is those opening lines. And there, it's a really beautiful set of lyrics in those first few words, and basically talking about trying to be a better person than what the world is going to see. And it sort of sets up the episode, both showing you, here's a guy who's a great singer and songwriter. Here's some poetic stuff that he just said, and it relates to his personality that we're now about to learn about. So I think it was really beautifully done. I love the way Billy Joe sings. I'm with that guy. If people have a hate voice, I'm always on the love side, like idiosyncratic voices. I'm all over it. So I love the way it started off with that, and I thought it was really beautifully done.
Yeah, I agree. And I liked the Live Forever at the end. I thought it was pretty powerful and a pretty good selection. Once again, this series is just highlighted by immaculate taste in the song selections and really clever in how they deploy the songs in the service of the story as well. So what was your favorite part of the episode?
So you alluded to it earlier and said it was kind of your favorite part, but I, you know, when I watched it again today, my favorite part was definitely when the young Billy Joe climbs up, shimmies up the pole to watch Hank Williams. And you get to hear Hank Williams sing for a second, which just raises the hair on your arms. And then the way that they sort of cut that, and you see the young Billy Joe sort of like struck by lightning in his face. It was just a really powerful and beautiful moment, and I thought that was definitely my favorite part of it.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes I get angry at you for stealing my favorite part, but I'll forgive you in this case. And my second favorite part, since we both had the same favorite part, my second favorite part was Kinky Friedman's contributions. I thought he was just hilarious and also touching and poignant, because he's talking about a friend who he knows really well, and I liked his line about you know, songwriting is you know, being a songwriter is to sail as close to the truth as you can without sinking the ship. And I thought that was a pretty poignant quote. And, you know, Kinky's one of those people, like they say, never meet your heroes. And I actually worked for him for a while, and it was a disaster. So this series has actually kind of helped me regain my lifelong fondness for Kinky Friedman's work and forget the unpleasantness of dealing with the person. So what was your favorite song? I guess we already covered that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm for me, it would have to be the beginning with Old Five and Dimers, though. Also, the way that they outro the show with Live Forever, which is such a real anthemic recording of that song with the beautiful guitar playing. They were wonderful bookends to the episode.
Yeah, I have to agree. And I think that Waylon's version of Honky Tonk Heroes in the middle is a great pillar to build the musical selection. Because, you know, like millions of other people, I mean, I memorized Honky Tonk Heroes growing up. My older brothers always played it. It was a, you know, 4th of July just favorite. It was just a staple of summertime in my family growing up. And so that's how it was very jarring when I learned that somebody else wrote those songs. When I first heard Billy Joe's versions, it was very hard for me to accept that it wasn't Waylon, but eventually I did learn to appreciate Billy Joe's version. But I still love that classic version of Waylon Jennings, and it sets us up. You know, next week we'll be talking about the Waylon Jennings two-parter, and there's just something about the greatness of Waylon Jennings as a performer that comes through that Billy Joe, for all his gifts, just can't compare. I mean, he's just not, you know, the legendary Waylon Jennings.
Not many can compare with Waylon.
No. I mean, you know, this is the king of kings of outlaw country. The only one who can go up against him would be Willie himself. So what was the funniest part?
This episode was kind of low-key funny the whole time, and there weren't as many sort of laugh-out-loud moments as some of the other ones. But for me, the time that I actually laughed out loud was at the beginning. It's Mike Judge setting up the episode, and he does the little, and like all the other episodes so far, he shot a guy. And just that perfect deadpan Mike Judge, just, you know, dropping the hammer. It's just so good. And I laughed out loud the first time I heard it.
Yeah, that one. And then the moment when Judge stops the show to clarify that, you know, even though Billy Joe is saying that the guy had a gun and shot at him three times, that the police, the court records, and all the eyewitnesses agree the guy only had a knife. Those were the two funniest parts. But like you said, there's just a general good humor about the whole episode. I mean, I think the whole cosmic cowboy phenomenon is pretty hilarious. And anybody who's familiar with that scene knows that it's funny. It's just, there's something about hillbillies on acid that is just inherently hilarious. So what was the saddest part of the episode?
Well, you go first. This is that way I can't steal your thunder.
I see. Well, to me, the saddest part is a little bit off stage, in that it's the tragedy of his childhood and the story that Kinky Friedman told about his father, you know, nearly killing him in the womb, and his mother abandoning him based on his gender. Although, you know, who can blame her after dealing with a man like that? Like, bringing another man in the world's got to be a difficult thing to do. So that's the saddest part. And then the death of his son, which again was pretty elliptical in the episode.
Yeah, they really glossed over it, but that's definitely the saddest part for me. You know, just, the, you know, especially the, when you've worked artistically with your own son, and that's got to be so rewarding. And then, you know, his life is just wasted so senselessly. It's really sad. And actually, when I was researching this, I realized there's a song written by singer-songwriter Todd Snyder called Waco Moon that is about the death of Eddie. And I would suggest anyone who's listened this far and is interested enough in all this to go listen to that song, because it kind of adds a little something to that story.
Cool. I will definitely check that out. Yeah, it's that's part of the greatness of this stuff, is just going down the rabbit trails and enhancing your knowledge. And that's kind of the magic of our era, is the internet lets you just dive in and do all this research so quick. And so do we like Billy Joe?
It is amazing. Of course we like Billy Joe. We love Billy Joe. Like, he's just a total delight.
Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of guy, I'm sure he's a handful to deal with on the day-to-day. And you wouldn't want to get crosswise with him in a bar fight or as a roommate, pulling knives on him and such. But unlike some of the folks in the series, I mean, yeah, he's funny and he's charming, and the guys he's fighting are big, tough dudes like himself. And it's there's none of that Jerry Lee Lewis picking on people kind of aspect to it. You know, Billy Joe's the little guy, the underdog, and definitely love going along the ride for his struggles and triumphs. And then recommended listening. I think obviously Honky Tonk Heroes by Waylon Jennings is the foundational text for Billy Joe. But as part of the research for this, I came across and really enjoyed listening to Old Five and Dimers Like Me, which is his first album, Kris Kristofferson produced in 1973 on Monument. And then his first Columbia album, I'm Just an Old Chunk of Coal. And that's the one that features Eddie Shaver on guitar. And then there's a great Razor and Tie 18-song compilation called Restless Wind that's got good liner notes, and it was worth ordering from Amazon for me. Have you checked any of those out, or you got any other recommendations?
Yeah, so when I was listening, and like you, like, I hadn't listened to a whole ton of Billy Joe. I was very familiar with, you know, who he was, you know, growing, being in Austin all this time, but really going back and spending some time listening to his music, I came across pretty much the same stuff you did, and agree those are the records to listen to. The one that I also really enjoyed was called Storyteller Live at the Bluebird, which is a live recording of an acoustic set. And it's just, it's got, you know, all a lot of the same songs, but just delivered in a really charming and sort of intimate setting. I think it's a great sort of complement to the ones that you already offered up.
Cool. I will definitely check that one out. And so where does this episode fit into the series? I think we already covered that. It sets up the Billy Joe, but sets up the Waylon Jennings two-parter. But where do you see it thematically in the series?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, like we said, it's sort of one of the more lighthearted ones. There's tragedy in there, but it's sort of presented, the whole episode is presented in a relatively upbeat way. And I think it's a little bit of a break after, you know, some of the real intense stuff that we've seen so far. And I think it's a nice little breather in a way. And like you said, it also sets us up ideally for Waylon.
Yeah, and that's what we'll be talking about next time on the show. So, Justin, thanks very much. It's been a hoot. And we'll be back next week finish this discussion with some Waylon Jennings. And then we'll
have a pleasure, as always.
All right. And so come back and listen again next time we let it roll. Thanks, everybody.
Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast. Come back next Monday when RJ Smith drops by to talk about James Brown and his biography, The One. And come back next Thursday as Nate and Justin will be back to talk more Tales from the Tour Bus featuring Waylon Jennings. Tales from the Tour Bus can be viewed on Amazon.com if you subscribe to Cinemax.